This is Forrest Solis interviewing Deborah Sussman-Susser on June 24th, 2015 at
6:47.
All right. So maybe you could take us back to around the time that you were pregnant or of the labor and delivery, just something to situate us. Was it like a hot summer or...
So I actually found out I was pregnant in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is where I had graduated from grad school. And I met the man I married there. And we had been seeing a fertility specialist. We'd actually been having some trouble getting pregnant. And the day we found out we were pregnant, I think, was also the day, if I remember correctly, that he passed his dissertation. They were like really sort of close to each other. And then within months, he had a job in Arizona. And we left Charlottesville and all of our friends and landed in Arizona in July, I think. And I was pregnant. And it was a little jarring. Looking back, I realized just how isolated I was, because I think it must be really nice to go through a pregnancy with your friends and your family around you to support you. I was very fortunate. I had a couple of names, people I was supposed to look up when I got here, and one of them was a guy named Dennis Gillingwater, who teaches in the School of Art. And Dennis's wife, it just so happened, was an OB nurse. That was what she did. And, you know, I'm not sure how much I believe in this, but it really was like, it was really fortuitous. I was very, very lucky to meet her. And so she told me, you know, which OBGYN to go to, which hospital to deliver it, the whole thing. I think otherwise it would have been a little scary. So I felt, I think, pretty secure in that. And I found a doula because I very much wanted not to go to the hospital until I had to. And I wanted to have as close to a natural childbirth as I could, you know, short of delivering in my living room. I did want to go to a hospital just in case. I worry. So I found a doula. The interesting thing was most of the sort of doulas and midwives and people that I knew were very liberal, and this woman was not, as it turned out. I think it's sort of like the homeschooling movement. Like, you get some people who are really liberal, and then you get some people who are like fundamentalist Christians and don't want their children to be contaminated. Yeah, and she was a little bit right of me on the political spectrum, and she liked country music, and, you know, it was interesting getting to know her, but I felt like she knew what she was doing, and she'd seen people deliver before, and so that was reassuring. And the whole pregnancy was very smooth. I'd had some depression before the pregnancy, and somehow when I was pregnant, it's like my moods stabilized. I was just even keeled, you know, excited about having a baby, excited to meet her, and really no sort of complications whatsoever. Kind of effortless, you know, up until the end when it was typical, but I also sort of felt like, oh, I see why people are less scared of giving birth as they approach, you know, you just want the baby out. It's like, okay, your home is too small. You need to come out into the world. And Anna was 2 weeks late. Or no, she was a week late. That's right. The due date was the Ides of March, March 15th. And she was born March 22nd. I had about 24 hours of, I don't know if it was false labor or Braxton Hicks, but my body kind of doing something. And I had a friend who was a midwife, interestingly enough. I had made a couple of friends just in the time that we were here. One of them was somebody in the religious studies department who was also pregnant and had a baby shortly before I did. And then the other woman was this midwife. She was from the East Coast and she hated Arizona. And she didn't stay here long, but she was here just long enough to help me. And she checked me and she's like, yeah, you're dilating, you know, but you're not at the point where you should go to the hospital. So I did a lot of, you know, sitting in the bath and walking around. And then we went for Chinese food because there's an old wives' tale that Chinese food precipitates labor. I thought I'll try anything. So we went to Chinese food. And that evening, you know, after about 24 hours of this false labor or whatever it was, I genuinely went into labor. And I called the doula, and she came over to our house, and she just helped me through the contractions, because they weren't really close enough yet to go to the hospital. And I'd heard stories about women going to the hospital with contractions and being sent home, and I didn't want that. I didn't want to spend more time in the hospital than I had to. I figured as long as I'm home and I'm comfortable and I'm okay, I'll stay here. And I think we went to the hospital like 4 a.m., something like that, 5 a.m. And then it took another 12 hours. I didn't want an epidural. I had a number of friends who were pretty crunchy, very lovely people, but it was all about natural childbirth. It was all about not introducing any chemicals or anything, you know, into your body and doing it naturally. I had a friend who was actually, shortly thereafter, she started studying midwifery at Bastyr in Seattle, and she had been looking into this, and she and another friend had recommended Spiritual Midwifery by Ina May Gaskins. And I'm not usually a very crunchy person, but this book made sense to me. And part of what it talked about is that we tend to think of pain as a sign that something is wrong. And the pain of a contraction is different. The pain of a contraction is telling you that everything is as it should be. And so what you need to do is ride it out. So our tendency with pain is to stiffen up and retract. And what my friend in the book explained is you have to see the contraction like a wave and you have to dive into it. And it's interesting. Because I knew theoretically what I was going to try and do. And I remembered being in the waves in California when I was a kid, and the whole, like, you really do have to dive into the wave or it will smack you down. So you have to just trust that if you dive under, you'll be okay, whereas if you stand there scared, you'll get smacked. And that, it helped. It worked. I mean, I can't say it wasn't painful, but it just is. It's a very different kind of pain. My daughter's terrified of childbirth. She said, I don't want to have kids. I know it's going to hurt. And I say, I know it's hard for you to understand, but it's just a different kind of pain. So I walked and walked and walked, and I think I had a shower, and eventually they informed me that I was stuck. I was 10 centimeters dilated on one side and 8 centimeters dilated on the other one, and I wasn't progressing. And so they wanted to give me an epidural and then Pitocin to get things going again. So I said, okay. And at that point, I think I was ready to have Anna and ready to be done with it. Anna's father said that that was the part where it became sort of scary for him, because there were needles and I was, you know, on the bed like a patient. So they gave me the epidural, and about 20 minutes later they didn't even have to do the Pitocin. They gave me the epidural, and I guess my body relaxed. I feel like I'd just been working so hard to get this baby out, wanting to do it right, and I needed to relax. So I had the epidural, and yeah, about 20 minutes later, Anna was born. And it was strange to be told to push and to not really know whether I was actually, I mean, I knew I was kind of doing the things with my body that I would normally do when I was pushing, but it's different. You don't feel that happening. You just have to trust that you're doing it. And that was strange. And she came out, and I had been anticipating a small dark-haired child because I was a small, pale baby with dark hair. My brothers were small, pale babies with dark hair. My mother and father in different countries had been small, pale children with dark hair. And she had copper hair. She had, like, flame-colored copper hair. And I just realized, this is a person. This is not... I imagined what it would be like, but you don't know until your child is born that this is a whole other person. This is an individual who's going to turn into her own person, so no longer just somebody who's part of your little projected fantasy about motherhood. This is a person. And that was exhilarating, and then I would say within the next 24 hours, kind of terrifying. Because in your fantasy, right, you're still you, you just have a kid. And the reality of I am fully and almost solely responsible for this small person who will become a grown-up, that's big. And I think for a woman especially, that's... you have to go through a readjustment. You know, I joined a writing group called Mothers Who Write pretty early on, and I tried to write about how I felt that I had given birth to Anna, but Anna in a way had given birth to me as a mother. In other words, not literally, but she made me a mother. I mean, this was like a whole different self, and without Anna, that never would have happened. I don't think it's better or worse, you know. It's very, very different. And not for everybody, you know. My father said, life without children is not complete. And I internalized that, but I also at the same time knew I wanted to be a writer and an artist, and I was never one of those kids or girls who played marriage, who wanted babies. I didn't play with dolls. That was just not part of my dream. And so having an actual child is a much richer and more complicated experience, I think, than what I thought it was when I was a little girl. I wanted to stay me, and I wasn't sure how I could become a stereotypical, you know, mother, or what I saw as a stereotypical mother, and still be me. And that's part of the reason I think that I took Mothers Who Write, and then I ended up teaching Mothers Who Write, and I've been teaching it for, I don't know, like 15 years or something, co-teaching it with Amy Silverman. It's because when you become a mother, you realize, I have one thing in common with other mothers, but I don't have a lot necessarily, in the same way that before you had a kid, you had something in common with women, but, and so to find a place where there were women who were mothers, but who also wrote, who saw the world through that writer's perspective, and saw motherhood through that writer's perspective, that was really reassuring. Because it was like, oh, we can talk about the crappy stuff. We can talk about postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety, you know, feeling like, when are we ever going to be able to get back to our own creative selves? You know, all of the stuff that there's not a lot of room for, I think, in the traditional notions of motherhood. You know, there's no Mother's Day card for that mother. It's the selfless mother who, you know, that giving tree mother? That's the mother that... And I feel really fortunate to have put together a group of friends, many of whom are mothers, and we love our children fiercely, but I don't think we're any of us that tree stump.
When I had August, I totally went through an identity crisis, like a severe crisis.
Yeah.
You know, it was really hard.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a depression. It was like, who am I?
That's what I had. I think it was a kind of identity crisis. And I realized, and maybe it's not true for every mother and every father, but it really seemed when I looked around that for mothers having a children, having children, right, having a baby, you gained something critical, but not in the short term, you lost something, right? And so you had to sort of cope with that loss. Whereas for fathers, it was like, do you know what I mean? I had a child. Like a mother gives birth, you give something away in a sense, right? And you get it back tenfold, but initially it's losing something, literally the baby out of your body, and then also a sense of kind of who you were, right? I mean, I remember, you know, looking at women's magazines. I don't know if it was, you know, Allure, you know, whatever it was, but those were a guilty pleasure of mine. And after I had Anna, like in the weeks after I had Anna, I just looked at those like, I can't make heads or tails. I don't, who are these for? They make no sense. It was like they were written in a foreign language, because what I was looking for was information that was so much more kind of primal and just about how to survive. And I did have postpartum anxiety, and I was told postpartum anxiety wasn't a thing, that really, postpartum depression, but there wasn't really, people didn't really get postpartum anxiety. So I had to cobble together my own remedies. One or two sort of older friends with kids said, you know, because it was around the witching hour, it was around 5 when I would start to get that panic. And Anna was an easy baby. Anna was not colicky, but I'd get this rising panic. And so I'd have a beer. It's like, okay, have a beer, just relax. I don't know what it was. It was this sense of being trapped that was really frightening. And interestingly enough, about a week and a half after I gave birth, Anna, we still don't know what happened, but she started pooping blood, just like straight blood. My husband's parents had come to see her for the first time. They were visiting, and the whole day they were there, I kept saying, Anna seems, she's too quiet. You know what I mean? She was really, like, she was sleeping. It's like, oh, good baby, she's sleeping, but she was too quiet. And his parents left to get groceries for dinner or something, and I changed her diaper, and there was just blood, just, you know, like raspberry jam, just like in the diaper. And so I called my husband and said, we need to go to the, you know, so we, I'm sure I called the OBGYN or the pediatrician first, and they said, go to the ER. And we did. And she spent a couple days at the hospital. You know, we went in through the ER, but then they took her into the hospital. And they couldn't really figure out what was going on. They said later, after, you know, a couple days of testing and x-rays and MRIs and all that stuff, they thought that either she'd contracted some sort of stomach virus and not been strong enough to kind of withstand it, you know, because grown-ups can throw up, right, but babies can't, or she was allergic to my breast milk. And I had been going to La Leche League religiously before giving birth, so I was like, there's no way she's allergic to my breast milk. That's not possible. And all the La Leche League ladies I called said, no, that's not possible. But what I found was that when she went into the hospital, when we had to go to the ER, I didn't have that panic. It's interesting. My husband couldn't handle it. He kind of couldn't be there. And I don't know how to explain it, but it was almost like a biological imperative. It was like, this is my kid. I'm, you know what I mean, with my kid, and we're figuring out what's going on, and I'm here for her, and I'm not going anywhere. And I know it sounds goofy because she was only a week and a half, but she was so strong and so brave. and so determined not to be there, they put her under a, it must have been an MRI, some kind of scanner, and they had sandbags to keep her from moving, you know, because she was a newborn. And she was pissed, and she was crying, and she wriggled out. Like, at 1.5 weeks, she wriggled out of the sandbags. And they had to take the thing up and, like, put her back in. And I just got a sense of this person, you know, a really strong sense of this person. And they told me not to breastfeed, that I should put her on Alimentum, which was this very expensive formula that came in a can. And, of course, all the La Leche League ladies said, oh, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. You must breastfeed her. So I started with the Alimentum, but I was pumping breast milk too, right? Because, you know, she was going to need my breast milk like that. So I was, and the La Leche League ladies, I mean, God bless them. I'm sure they meant well. But they said, oh, well, you need to pump. You need to mimic the baby's feeding cycle. So you need to be pumping every 2 hours, like even at night, right? So I'm trying to feed the baby the bottle and pump every 2 hours. And my husband is like, yeah, and I'm going out of town. It's just like, in the end, somebody, maybe his mother, talked him into canceling that trip. It was just like, you can't do this right now. Yeah. And then my mother was the one who said, you're making yourself crazy. You need to just give her the bottle and she's okay. And she was, but I continued pumping breast milk and occasionally trying to put her back on the breast milk. And every time I did, the blood returned. They had given me a little kit so that I could test her feces to see if the blood was there. And it was microscopic, but it was there. And eventually I just thought, you know, it's not worth it. It's not this sort of stubborn insistence that, you know, breast milk would be better for her. I need to let go of that. So, but we had breast milk in the freezer for, oh, months, because I was like, it's liquid gold. We can't just throw it away. And, you know, 3 months after I gave birth, my sister-in-law, my brother's wife, gave birth to twins. Very difficult pregnancy. She had, I think, preeclampsia. I mean, it was scary. And she came home from the hospital with the two babies, and we went to visit, and my mother was there in Boston helping out, and so my mother was giving the babies, you know, a bottle at night. And I'd been so brainwashed by the La Leche League that I had the temerity to say to my mother, who had delivered, by the way, me and then twins, right, and raised us, you know, pretty capably, yeah, should you really be giving them a bottle? Like, what about nipple confusion? Like, really, should breast milk, shouldn't they? Okay, so here's this woman who's come out of the hospital. She's very, very sick, and she's got twins, and I'm trying to convince yeah. And I look back, and I realize, especially that first baby, I mean, I had a miscarriage. I didn't have a second child, which in the long run was a very good thing, but that first baby, you're just grasping. You have no clue, really. And I didn't have that village around me of, you know, friends who'd had babies or aunts or none of that. And so, you know, you're looking for gospel, right? And so you kind of take it where you find it. And then I think if you parent well, you sort of realize no baby should be parented by one gospel or with one approach. You need to tailor your approach to the child and what the child needs. And my mother, being English, was very sensible. I mean, she really was sensible. And my mother breastfed us in the 60s when that really wasn't done. And she said, I don't care, I'm going to breastfeed them. I mean, I don't think she did it for very long, but, you know, she's sort of very rational. And it's really easy in those early days of motherhood to lose that rational sense of yourself, of the world, of perspective. The whole thing just goes upside down. It really helps to have other people there you trust. We had one neighbor who had two older girls, and she would come by and check on me. And she loved babies, and she, you know, would take Anna. And so to see somebody holding Anna and delighting in her, you know, that helped me ease up a little bit. That helped me relax a little bit. And she was one of the people who said, it'll go really fast, which, of course, you don't believe at the time, but here I am 17 years later. So I think somebody said, how do the weeks go by so quickly when the days go by so slowly? You know, it's that weird bubblegum time, you know, of early motherhood. Kind of none of it makes sense. And my guess is the second child, you kind of know a little bit and you're more comfortable with it. But everybody says being a grandparent is great because then you could just enjoy it. So, you know, someday, I hope, if we're lucky enough, I'll get to, you know, really revel in having a baby in my life, and instead of sort of fighting that encroaching panic, which interestingly enough, it comes back when I remember the specific details of giving birth, but, you know, describing it for Anna or talking to Anna about, you know, her birth and delivery, and the doctor who delivered her was named Dr. Moon, and that became like a story in our family, Dr. Moon. And then when Anna was old enough, you know, she's a teenager now, so when she was old enough to need to go to, you know, the gynecologist, you know, she went to Dr. Moon. And it's sort of amazing to say, like, okay, this is the doctor who delivered you, and now you're going to have your first pap smear. Or not, I don't think they did a pap smear. I don't think they do that until your first sort of vaginal exam, you know, to make sure that all your bits are working in case you ever want to do that, you know? So,
kind of the evolution of our identity and character is fascinating to me, you know, like what you're saying, just imagining her becoming a woman and becoming a mother and then becoming a grandmother, and, you know, how our identity just changes so much over the course of our lives in a much more profound way, I think, than some men experience and secondhandedly experience.
Right. And yet, so my father was incredibly nurturing and incredibly invested in family and having children, and that was a huge part of his identity. And the one thing he would always say about his father was, you know, he may not have been successful in other ways, but he was a tremendous father. And yet, even for my father, I feel there was only a sense of addition, not a sense of subtraction. And my mother, I don't know. My mother, interestingly enough, so my mother, you know, tests as male on the Myers-Briggs. You know, she was not the touchy-feely one. So maybe for her it really was just, I don't mean to minimize it, but I don't know that she felt that same sense of loss. I think it was okay, and now I have children. I mean, I'm sure it was difficult, and I'm sure there was probably some anxiety, I think. I don't know that she necessarily connected that to having children, but having three kids under three and a husband who was gone a lot, I now understand why her voice sometimes edged toward, you know, hysteria.
I do know.
Yeah. And but I don't know, and I've never really tried to talk to her about that sense of kind of losing yourself. And I don't know whether she would say, yeah, I experienced that, or, you know, oh, don't be silly. You know.
How did you experience pregnancy and the physical changes? I mean, did you feel good about that experience?
I felt great about all the physical changes that came with pregnancy. I had one friend who put on a ton of weight. She was unrecognizable. And, you know, she had two kids, and it was the same both times. Very difficult. I had a friend who had gestational diabetes, you know. So I had no idea going in. And it was easy. It was so easy. I had some morning sickness, if you can even call it that, the first trimester. But what I figured out was I would get nauseous when I was hungry. and I just needed to have some crackers or something, and then I'd be okay. Certain foods I loved, I did not love when I was pregnant. Like, I had to leave a friend's house when they were making sweet potatoes for dinner one night, because I was just like, and I love sweet potatoes, but I was just like, I cannot handle that smell. I need to leave. I had to walk out into the street. But there wasn't a lot of that. There wasn't a lot of, I can't eat this, or, and, you know, my breasts got bigger, which was delightful because I'm not a wildly large-breasted person. And people would say that I was very skinny, and, you know, I kind of looked like I swallowed a basketball. Like, that was sort of the only place where the weight showed. And, yeah, I felt good. I felt really good. I felt healthy. You know, I'm sure not smoking had something to do with that, because as soon as I found out I was pregnant, I just quit. I had it was like a project. It was like my body had this really interesting project, and I was kind of following along, and I kind of couldn't believe that my body was doing that. And I think I'd had some, you know, body image stuff, and like a lot of women, I think, you know, I didn't like my body, and I thought it needed to be different. And after I gave birth, I was like, no, my body's good. This is good. My body did a good thing. And I also felt much less embarrassed about, you know, not having clothes on around people. Like, I really didn't care. I grew up very, very shy. Didn't really want to wear shorts because my legs were skinny, you know. Yeah. After having Anna, it was like, okay, my body's a machine that can do an incredible thing. And, you know, it's also fabulous, but, you know, there was much more, I felt much more connected to my body. I think that's what it was. I don't think I'd ever felt particularly connected to my body. I wasn't really in it a lot of the time. And having Anna changed that. Being pregnant, I think, changed that. Because I needed to be there. I needed to be in touch with this person growing inside me. And it was cool to be present. And joyful.
That's really well said. I feel like I fought against it the whole way.
Really?
I do. So much of it, you know, it would be like laying in bed and I'd have to sleep with ice packs because my legs tingled every night and they kept me up. Like, just the littlest things I felt were challenging in ways that were hard to overcome.
But
know?
That might have been, I mean, like, I knew women who had intense nausea the whole 9 months. It's like, I'm sorry, I don't think I'd be able to do that. You know what I mean? That just intense nausea, vomiting for 9 months up until they had the baby. And I just feel really, really grateful because I'm not somebody who doesn't complain. So, you know, it was an easy pregnancy, and Anna was an easy baby, and I wouldn't necessarily have predicted that for myself. I don't know that I was an easy baby. I think I had stomach issues, very little, and there was screaming. And I just remember my mother coming to see Anna for the first time and spending time with her and holding her, and she said, "This is a good baby." You know? And she is. I mean, she has not had an easy time of it. You know, there have definitely been challenges, but she is the same sort of strong, resilient, kind of lovely person she always has been. And sometimes I tell her stories about that strong, resilient baby, because I think it's easy to remember just the part of the story about having to go into the hospital with something wrong with you, which is scary. But the other part of that is you were strong and you emerged healthy, I remember saying to the pediatric gastroenterologist, I really want Anna to have breast milk. And she said, you're being ridiculous. She said, if this were a third world country where the water was compromised, you know, of course, breast milk. But the differences are sort of minimal. And you should feel fortunate because there are other children who've come in with very, very similar symptoms who may not leave here. Right? So, you know, my kid was in for 2 or 3 days and then was able to go home. And yeah, she was on crazy expensive formula that came in a can that we had to pack in our luggage anytime we went anywhere because we weren't sure they would sell it where we were going. But she was fundamentally healthy. So.
Yeah, we've interviewed women in different eras, and they did not have formula. They just made stuff up. It was like
right.
some cow's milk with some cream of wheat, like mixed in, and just the strangest concoctions trying to figure out. And the kids would, the babies would just be like throwing that up until they just found the right formula of things just to give their child nutrition so that they survived. I mean, it was really amazing. So I agree that we should be grateful for the, you know, the advances that we've made and
right.
that we have something like that. If we're in a circumstance like that, that you actually have the ability to use.
And I had a friend in New York who was really insightful, and she's a staunch feminist. And she, her sort of opinion was that this whole breast versus bottle thing was ridiculous. You know, some women will breastfeed, some women will bottle feed. It's a little bit like the stay-at-home mom versus the working mom, right? I mean, we're all mothering, we're all parenting, we're all... So I almost feel like this need to critique the person who's doing the other thing comes from this tremendous insecurity that I may not be doing it the right way, so I must criticize the other person. And some of that's societal pressure, for sure, absolutely, right? You know, blame the mom. It's always the mom's fault. But I also think it's up to us as women, as mothers, to say, this person mothers differently. And that's okay. I mean, they're not beating their child, right? They're feeding them formula. And that's their choice. And the sort of looking down the nose or... It's not okay, and it doesn't serve anybody in the long run, because the pendulum swings, right? The pendulum, one moment the pendulum is, you know, on the side of the women who are breastfeeding, and the next minute, right, early 60s when women were working, it was on the side of formula. I mean, breastfeeding was old-fashioned. It was backwards. It was, why would you do that, right? So it's always going to swing, mm-hmm. and it's...
My husband's mother died when he was... just after he was born, and he was completely raised on formula. He's like the smartest person I know, you know, the healthiest person I know, you know, so. But the guilt surrounding every decision we make is really...
Oh, the guilt about not being able to breastfeed Anna? That was, oh yeah, terrible. And I... at a certain point really let go of it. I think I really got angry at the people in the La Leche League who kept trying to push me to put her back on breast milk, because I realized this is not about my baby. This is not about what's best for my baby. This is about their what's the word I want? Kind of ideological beliefs about what's best, which doesn't take into account, you know, my child who's pooping blood. And so I got angry. And those people sort of abandoned me. Like, once I couldn't breastfeed and I wasn't part of the club, you know what I mean? We didn't have anything to talk about. We really didn't. Because I was doing something that they really didn't think was right. So instead of feeling rejected, I felt angry. It was good. It just made me think, well, okay, then fuck all y'all. I'm going to do what's right for my baby. And
which is what being a good mother is.
I think so. Right? It's trying to figure out what's right for my baby. Trying to figure out what's right for my baby without completely sacrificing myself, right? So the very early, like, I'm going to pump every 2 hours and give my child formula was kind of crazy. And it comes back to the whole idea. I remember having this revelation when Anna was little and we were on an airplane, and now people talk about it quite a bit, right? When the oxygen mask comes down and you're with a child, what do? Right? You put it on the kid first. No, you don't. You put it on yourself first, because if you put it on the kid first and you pass out, you're useless. So you have to put your own oxygen mask on first. You have to take care of yourself. And that, too, I think was another lesson that I learned. I really had to value myself more, and I really had to take care of myself if I was going to be able to take care of Anna, and if I was going to be able to set any kind of example for her to follow, right? Because kids do what they see, not what they're told. That's how they learn. It doesn't matter what you... I mean, you can say to your child, take care of yourself until you're blue in the face, but if you set an example of self-neglect, doesn't matter what you say. So that, in a way, gave me permission to take care of myself, to value myself, because I kind of hadn't before then.
Yeah, that's huge.
I'm pretty grateful, and I do... The marriage did not end well. Anna's relationship with her father is not good. But I wouldn't do it differently. I can't imagine my life without Anna in it. And I lost my father a few years before Anna was born, which was really difficult because grandchildren would have meant so much to him. But in parenting Anna, in being there for Anna, so much of what I do comes from what I learned from my father. My mother too, but my father. My father was very nurturing, very steady, very loving, just unconditional love. And so I feel my father with me in some way when I'm with Anna. Just the way I feel about Anna, I kind of feel like I get a sense of how my father felt about us. And that's really reassuring and lovely. It's almost like having some time with him again.
It's beautiful. I absolutely agree with that. I view my mother completely differently now that I've become a mother than I did before, you know.
I'm much more forgiving of my mother now. My mother and I did not get along, partly because we're so different. You know, my mother is a very practical English economist, and I'm kind of dreamy ADD. I don't know about dreamy, but do you know what I mean? Like, I'll go off in a strange direction, or I'll... Here's a small example that sums us up. I have a very keen sense of smell, and my mother does not. And so for years, my mother thought I was making it up. If I said something in the fridge smelled, you know, say, oh, don't be ridiculous, you know. And finally, my mother has recognized that I can smell things that she can't smell, right? And so she's come to appreciate that. It's like just because I sense something or feel something or smell something that she doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And I guess when you become a mother, you realize, oh, wow, my mother was a person, like she had a whole life before she had me. I am not the center of her universe, was not the center of her universe. She did not exist solely to take care of me and, you know, be a great mom to me. And she and I were very, very different people. And I had twin brothers 2 years younger. So that's a lot to deal with. And Two, I think the older you get and the more you see how parents fuck their kids up, I mean radically fuck their kids up, the more you look back and you think, wow, you know, I had it pretty good. I mean, I knew my parents loved me. I knew my parents were there for me. My mother and I operated very differently in the world, but I have a huge amount of respect for her. And Anna gets along really well with her. She and Anna sort of understand each other, and they both, it's very sweet. They, you know, Anna loves horseback riding and horses, as did my mother. She rode in England. I was never a horsey girl. That was not, I was like, yeah, horses were for girls, right? But they have this sort of bond that's really lovely. So I definitely feel like I understand my mother a lot better, and she and I respect and value each other in a way that we did not. Boy, I would say it was a combination of my father dying and Anna being born that sort of forced us to recognize each other and forge a real relationship. Not that it wasn't real before, but a deeper relationship.
That's a nice phrase, to recognize each other.
Don't you think? Yeah, I mean, on my birthday, it's not about me. I call my mother. I'm like, thank you so much for giving birth to me, right? Because it's her day as much as it is mine. And when you're a kid, it's all about you and the cake and the presents, and you don't even think about, like, this woman gave birth to me. So, yeah, I love that shift in perspective.
Yeah, it was like, you know, I remember right before being pregnant, having August, that I would see women in the grocery store, they'd have like three kids, you know, like hanging on the carts and stuff, and they'd be like, oh, that's cute, or, oh my gosh, the kids are heathens, or whatever my opinions were. And then immediately afterwards, it was like, wow, she has three kids.
The person with the screaming baby on the plane, right? Now it's like, oh, I feel so bad for you. And when other people complain, you know, about the screaming baby on the plane, I want to say to them, I hope people were kinder to your mother when you were a screaming baby, because you probably were, because most babies are at some point. You know, we just lose this sense of kindness or compassion or kind of understanding, right? It's like no parent wants to be sitting on an airplane holding a screaming baby.
Oh. It does sort of put you in context to the whole length of, you know, life. You know, I mean, you see everything in context of that. So, like, you see the old man, you think of him as a baby.
Totally.
You know?
I don't think I ever felt quite as kind of close to death, right, as I did when Anna was born. It's because you're at that door. It's the same door I was at when my father died 3 years before she was born, right? It's the door where you say hello and goodbye. And you can't be at that door and not think about passing through it. I don't think. I mean, unless you're of the generation of women that was just totally knocked out and then woke up like with a baby. Although, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how they felt, but It's really altering, profoundly altering. You know, now I'm married to a man from a Polish Catholic family who had 8 siblings. And I wonder, and his mother is so lovely and sane and even-tempered. And I just want to take her aside and say, how? And she lost a child. One of her children was killed, you know, when he was, I don't know, 8? How the hell do you keep it together for the other children in the face of that, you know? I had one baby and was just completely upside down, you know? Couldn't make heads or tails of it for a while.
One of the other women we talked to today said that having a child really, you know, that you find this well of strength, or this reserve that you just didn't know was there. And I think that situation would be like that, you know, where you just...
There's no question. I mean, in some ways, I guess I knew I was resilient. You know, I'd had a certain amount of depression, but not debilitating. And somehow Anna brought it out in me. I feel much stronger. And I don't know whether that's because I can't break down. I don't know. It's just not an option. It's not an option. It's not. And I don't mean to denigrate people with mental illness. I mean, you know, breakdowns happen. But I feel in my case, you know, there is... I mean, for example, when Anna was two and I had a miscarriage, my therapist had been saying for a while, you know, you might want to think about going on antidepressants before this, right? Because I'd been grappling with depression probably since adolescence. But I felt like that was a cop-out. You know, I don't want to take pills. I don't want, you know, it'll change who I am. And I had the miscarriage, and Anna was two, and my marriage was not good. And I just started taking the antidepressants. I thought, okay, this is not about what I prefer. I need to be okay. I need to function for Anna's sake. I need to be good. I took a very low dose, but it was enough. And, you know, the marriage did end up collapsing pretty spectacularly. And I hung in there. I don't know that I was always at my best, but I didn't have the option of throwing my hands up or walking away or, you know, curling up in a ball and crying. I just needed to figure out what to do for Anna's sake, needed to figure out what the right thing was to keep Anna safe.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
we've been asking people, because we're separating the stories into themes, if there's like a particular word or a small grouping of words that could kind of summarize your experience. It's a really hard question, but
yeah, but I'm a writer, so I should be able to do this. A grouping of words. A group of words that's not like an egregious cliche.
You've already given us like three really, I mean, like specifically really good that would, you know, work in that context.
You want to tell me what they are, and then I can work around them.
God, there's so many. Ashley has all the notes of the really good parts.
I mean, just like starred the moments, though. I mean, honestly, it was like, I think three or four times I wrote end quote, like, because they were so good.
They're really good.
I didn't write down what they were, though.
Gosh, there were so many. Well, when you were saying she gave birth to you, that was really great.
Yeah.
You know?
I think... connection. So Anna connected me back to my father, who was the center of my world. She connected me to myself. In a funny way, that's where my father was. And she connected me forward in a funny way. I feel like in the same way that my father is around, I will be around. Not literally, right? But my father shaped me. I've shaped Anna. Even if Anna doesn't choose to have children, every life she touches, every person that she has a relationship with, or, you know, that's the ripple. That's the ripple out. And so connected.
Yeah, it's beautiful. That's great.
That was like the best way to end.